it's that thing that you never really, like 10 years down the line, I won't remember the food I was eating in that restaurant. Unless it's that one dish, which I'll always remember. But I will always remember how the restaurant made me feel. And 90% of that is the people who are serving me.
That was our fabulous guest from this episode. And this is Beyond the Pass. Conversations with people from all walks of hospitality life. Centering mental health, Beyond the Pass is a conversation about life, hospitality, and what makes us get out of bed each day. Beyond the Pass is brought to you by Kelly's Cause, and the conversational digressions are brought to you by me, your host, Rachel Kerlapsley. If you can take a minute to like, rate, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, that would be very much appreciated. Without listeners like yourselves, we couldn't keep having these brilliant conversations. Enjoy the episode and keep taking care of each other. Welcome back to Beyond the Pass. I am so excited to be sitting down with George Gill. George is the community manager at Code and the Good Food Guide and is all about shining a spotlight on restaurants that embody incredible workplace culture. Having grown up in his family-run delicatessen, his passion for hospitality grew while working in the world of rural weddings and Bristol cafes. With a deep passion for the industry, he's dedicated to celebrating the spaces where teams thrive and guests feel the love. Welcome, George.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Pleasure. I want to get started by asking, sort of before you got into the industry, what was your impression of restaurants? Like when you were a kid and you're going out to eat, if you ever did that, what did you think it was?
I'd say it's a straight, I had like a strange split experience of restaurants as a child. One half was going to the restaurants near to me, where the best thing we had was a Pizza Express. And it was like, it was when Pizza Express, I think, was starting to hit the downhill. Mm. And it was bad. But that was like our local restaurant. And then the other side of that was when, like, for someone's birthday, my mum worked in London. So we'd like come and meet my mum for dinner in London. And we'd go to like Sheikis or something. Mm. So my experience on the local level, I was like, why do we go to these places? They're not good. And it's like, it's a 45-minute drive and we have a bad experience and then we go home. But then my experience in London was like, it was almost kind of mythical because I'd go to this place and then as like a 7-year-old bopping about London, I'd just sort of like be pulled out onto the tube and I'd never see it again and I wouldn't understand how to get there or like, you know, where it is. So I think that was a very kind of like inspirational childhood experience of restaurants because they sort of took on this slightly ethereal, mythical status in my mind where I was like, I don't know where they are or what they are, but they're great.
Do you remember something in particular you would eat when you were out in London?
Yeah, every time if we went to Sheikis, I'd have fish and chips. It was like the size of my arm. And I just have a great time. And I was like, this is the best thing ever. Because we also had the sort of, you know, in all the villages in the UK, you have fish and chip vans, which come on a Friday. And the fish and chips were atrocious. But the fish and chips at Sheikis were good at the time. And so I was like, this is the best thing ever. And I really remember that. And you'd have the little lemon in the cloth bag and the vinegar in your own personal bottle. And I felt like a king just for the day. It felt so great. And I really remember we went for my sister's 18th. And, you know, like it was an expensive restaurant for us anyway. But then my sister was like, I'm turning 18. I'm going to have the lobster thermidor. It's £90. She was like, it's my birthday. I was like, yes, that doesn't entitle you to a £90 lobster thermidor. So yeah, she was used to get the most expensive item. I'd just have fish and chips without fail. I'm a simple person.
Perhaps as also a simple person and someone who is Jewish, can you explain to me, we don't do shellfish, can you explain to me what a lobster troubadour is?
Thermidor. I think a lobster troubadour would be some sort of dance group.
I'm sort of imagining Sebastian from The Little Mermaid.
It's just like isn't it like lobster with cheese and it's all baked? I think it's disgusting.
Is lobster and cheese a combination that is fancy?
I don't know. Let me look it up because I think I'm not doing it justice. Lobster thermidor. It looks like cheese to me. It's like lobster cut in half, baked with some sort of, it's like stuffed. It's in like a rich sauce.
Did she enjoy it?
She loved it. She found out she was allergic to shellfish shortly after. So I think it was a really good time for her. Yeah.
Like, did she have a reaction that day, or was that like her last shellfish meal?
No, almost definitely had a reaction that day, proceeded to continue to eat it. And then I think it kind of like it reached a ceiling point where I think the level of illness following the Thermidor was like, it's not worth it.
I'm actually dying. That's so there that's so beautiful.
Yeah, she really loved the Thermidor so much.
That's so nice. I feel like there's certain things where if I knew I was going to eat that thing for the last time, I would be like, I want the most balls to the walls version of this thing. And she really did it.
Yeah, she did it. She thermidored the hell out of
She
it.
thermidored the hell out of it. Is lobster thermidor something we can still find on the menu, or was it very of that era?
It's definitely of the era, but I reckon if you go to like Bellamy's or somewhere like that, or probably still Sheaky's, they've probably still got it there. You know, these places don't change.
I don't keep kosher. I should go.
Yeah, you should. I wouldn't get it, but you should go.
Yeah, my sister ate it and got really sick, but definitely
Yeah, every
that was
time.
an allergy.
It was.
Yeah, I recently started eating. I mean, I've obviously had shellfish before in my life every once in a while, like when I left home. But now that I'm dating an Irish person, I've like really gotten into it. And I had crab claws for the first time like 2 years ago, and I lost my mind. I was like, oh, like.
Oh, I'm not a shellfish person.
I think you'd like it more if it was forbidden to you growing up.
Yeah, probably. I think my mum, so like, while my sister's allergic to it, my mum's also like a massive hypochondriac. So any idea of eating like any shellfish, she's like illness, guaranteed food poisoning. So I'm just sat there looking at oysters, and if they're out of ice for more than a second, I'm like, well, this is off. Put it in the bin immediately.
I can actually really relate to that. And I think that my only understanding of what shellfish was, because I never saw it prepared, was people in like movies and on TV getting sick from eating shellfish. So when I started to eat shellfish, my paranoia around that was at like an all-time high. And so every time I ate it, I would like turn to my partner and be like, "Can you smell this?" And she'd be like, "Rachel, just eat it." But then last year, she got food poisoning from a dodgy mussel. So.
Yeah, it does have that happened to me last year, and I felt pretty horrific.
Yeah,
So
food poisoning is hell, true hell.
it is hell, yeah. And you know, and the thing is, you go back the next day, like, yeah, I'll have some more.
Yeah, it's funny how you get sort of like if something makes me incredibly sick, I'm probably not going to do that thing again. But with food poisoning, you're like, this ruined my life, but I
I
gotta
want
eat.
it again.
Yeah.
You've got to eat, and it was bloody delicious.
Yeah, I want that weird mac and cheese they serve on the train, you know?
Yeah. I
It's gotta be train food, right?
don't
Like,
think they do that here.
I got really, the first time I ever had food poisoning, I was on a train from Lisbon to Porto, and I had half of a ham sandwich that I bought at the train station, and the person I was dating at the time had the other half, and we were long distance, and we were doing like a romantic weekend in Portugal. It was not. We both just like threw up and had diarrhea for the next 3 days and like saw nothing.
It's a tough one to it's a tough one to overcome on a romantic holiday, I think.
It wasn't easy.
Really.
We're good friends now, and I think that might be why.
Yeah, there's a real bonding experience in there.
That's it. That's it.
But not a romantic one.
Can you tell me what your first job was in hospitality after the glitz and glamour of the lobster troubadour?
Yeah, the after the lobster thermidor
Troubadour.
drew me in. The
Thermidor.
troubadour. The troubadour's a club, isn't it? I think. Yeah, I had a very equally I compared to the Thermidor, my start in hospitality was very unglamorous. I worked in my family. My auntie lived in the same village as me, and she ran a deli. And so, at like six, I was sort of a child stood on a short stool, kind of like leaning his body halfway into the chocolate counter to reach the one at the end for the person who wanted it.
Was that your task, like object retrieval?
I was on the chocolate counter. Which I think must have been like quite a disconcerting thing for an adult coming in and this sort of tiny, tiny boy being like, "And what would you like to get your wife this Valentine's?" Like, sort of very, very like too old beyond his years.
Do these chocolates say, "I'm sorry for flirting with the waitress"?
Literally, they were like the most apologetic chocolates you've ever seen, and it's like one of those chocolate counters you never see anymore. It was like 40 different of those little chocolates, and you never know what's inside. And I'm there telling them, they're like, "What's in this one?" I'm like, "Let me check for you. I think it's mint." I got no idea. So that happened. And then it kind of all snowballed from there. I worked for an events company and did like weddings for 7 years. It was, it feels like from 16 to 24, was just like, I shouldn't have been allowed to manage weddings. I really remember just like this bride and groom coming up to me and being like, can we push forward the salmon? And I was just like, I don't know. Like, I don't know how these things work. Probably.
I'm a chocolate expert.
Yeah, this isn't my field. I was like, I only do lobster thermidors and chocolate. But yeah, and then when I went to uni, that's kind of where I got into sort of proper full-time hospitality. And I worked in the sort of in between the kitchen and the cafe front of house for 3 years. I think I was doing like 35 hours a week. So I don't know where I found the time to do uni. But that's when I really started loving it. Yeah, and then kind of flirted with the idea when I came to London. But I think I mentioned to you before, I did six to eight weeks in a basement kitchen of an over-under cafe. And I loved the people. I didn't love the lack of daylight. And then kind of like flicked out for a bit, did some odd mixture of jobs, and then started off at Code. So yeah, it's been an unconventional journey, I'd probably say.
I feel like the London basement and not seeing the light of day is sort of a kitchen rite of passage in this town.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think also it was like, I wouldn't mind if... No, actually, I would mind. No, there's no way to redeem a kitchen basement. Like, I think if there's other people in there, I was the only one down there. So I think it was like, it was very isolating. And there was someone upstairs doing the coffee, but I'd maybe seen them twice in 7 hours. It's just like, I was just down there making egg breakfast burritos like no one's ever seen.
They should do an I'm a Celebrity, but that's there and not in the jungle.
Yeah, honestly, there was no aircon either.
That's and what I want to see Nigel Farage do for weeks.
Yeah, honestly, it was a testing time, I think. I listened to a lot of audiobooks, and the thing was they sort of took a darker and darker turn as I went through that. I was like, oh no, this is not good. Get me out.
I know that you're the community manager at Code and for the Good Food Guide. What exactly does that mean?
It's a good question, which sometimes I don't necessarily fully know the answer to. But I think I'm responsible for kind of like making sure that our community is engaging with the content we're producing and making sure it's relevant to them, but also making sure that it's kind of touching on the points where we're trying to drive the conversation forward. And kind of, you know, at Code, a big part of the thing is our membership offers, which I kind of like feed into a little bit and give my feel on. I'm sort of responsible for reaching out to the members and being like, what do you want to see on Code? Like, how can we make this the most valuable product for you? But then my more heavy lift day-to-day stuff is doing our flagship campaigns. And so that's 30 Under 30, Women of the Year, Happiest Places to Work. And kind of like curating and doing those and working with the rest of the team to make them happen. And then also all our kind of ad hoc events as well. Like we did a founder series. So sort of doing those and yeah, creating content which is really relevant to our community, which is really fun. I'm very grateful for the opportunity to be able to do it. And then I do the same on Good Food Guide, and we're finding more and more overlap with that. But yeah, my focus sort of until now is mainly being Code, probably.
I'm curious, because you are so on the ground with the members that are using Code, in the years that you've been doing it, how have you sort of seen what the membership base wants and needs with everything that sort of happened in the past 5 years?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we're definitely seeing that just people are eating out less. I think, you know, among people who really love hospitality, there's this sort of, you know, understanding that everyone spends all of their spare cash seemingly on eating out because that's what they love to do. And I'm the same. I spend all my money on it. But I think we're seeing that people are just struggling to eat out more and more. And so it's finding that sweet spot with the offer side of things as to what is somewhere someone really wants to go and they wouldn't be going for the sake of eating out, but also that we can provide an attractive enough offer that they would be motivated to go there because it's on Code, which is actually kind of like the hardest center point for us to hit, because generally the places people don't want to go, people do want to go, need people to be driven to their restaurants the least, which is a factor of being on Code. And obviously there are some really generous restaurants who run really generous offers because they love the industry and they want to give back. But equally, there are also restaurants who do need to see that return on investment side of things. So it's a very like fine line we're trying to tread at the moment. I think a big example of that is the Hawksmoor offer pre-COVID. We did 50% off food.
I remember.
And I think every single code member misses that offer. And they do 25% off food now, and it's still great, and we're still really like glad to have them on. And you know, you're not going to sniff at 25% off food, but equally, probably you wouldn't factor going out to Hawksmoor as much now into your plan, because 25% off food just isn't quite the same pull as 50% off food.
No, and like 50% off food is like, okay, I could go to like my local kebab shop and get my feast, or I could go to Hawksmoor and get my feast. You know, it makes it quite competitive in terms of that everyday dining. Although then you'd miss out on your kebab, which would be sad. But there is like, there's something interesting about that. But I remember when I moved here and I was making like 27K a year, and what a fucking terrible job that was. I found an old pay stub recently and I was like, surely not. Because in the same email that my pay stub was on, I also had my rota for the next week. And I was like, how does somebody working that much make this little money? Anyway, neither here nor there. I was so broke. And so I was working in a restaurant and I was obviously in London and I was talking to all these people and all the chefs at my job were recommending all these places. And the only reason that I could ever afford to go out and eat at a restaurant was because of code. They were like, we're going to pay you 27K a year, but you get this code membership. And I was like, what is that? But it really enabled me to go out and try different places and take me to new neighborhoods. And I think particularly in getting to know the city and getting to know the food scene, it was so valuable. And I think because so often in hospitality, the work can be quite low paying, you can spend your entire career giving people this experience and never being on the receiving end. And to bridge that gap and make that more possible, I think is an incredible sort of motivation.
Yeah, and I think that's something we often talk about with employers when we're maybe looking at sort of like bringing their whole team on code. It's that ability for their team to go out and experience the industry which they're a part of and see how incredible that can be. But I think probably something we're finding is that pre-COVID, there was a generation of people in hospitality who had maybe been there a while, and word of mouth maybe was a much more valuable tool in kind of spreading the word of code. Whereas now we're definitely looking at a fresh generation of entered who don't communicate so much through word of mouth. And it's kind of getting them to understand and share the benefits of being in hospitality between each other, which is so much harder because I do a night a week in a restaurant as well. And everyone on the front of house, it's a very obvious split. Anyone who's been in hospitality sort of before COVID, they're aware of what code is. Anyone who hasn't, I'm like, oh, I also work for code. And they're like, what is that? Do you do coding? And I'm like, no, I don't do coding. And they just sort of have no idea. And I'm like, oh, but you could be getting discounts at so many. You're saying you're going there. We do a discount there. And they're just like, oh, really? And it's just, it's that broken link maybe at the moment with some people where we're still trying to sort of figure out how we can really, you know, make the most of being in the industry for everyone who's in it, because there are so many great benefits, like you say. But maybe just there's got to be a different approach to communicating with this new generation.
Thinking about the difference in the culture of a restaurant or in the scene sort of in general from the time I was 20 to the time I was 25 to 30, the shift recently in the past few years has been just enormous. I think with COVID, like you mentioned, with Me Too, I think generally that new generation that you're talking about and their sort of tolerance for mistreatment is a lot lower. How do you think that food media has sort of contributed to that evolution of the industry in terms of workplace practice or hindered that evolution?
I don't necessarily think it's hindered the evolution, but I don't think food media has worked to support and catalyze an evolution beyond those kind of problems that we're still facing. I think if you look at other industries, there's more of a responsibility being taken by the industry to call out malignant sort of forces within it. And I don't think that's necessarily happening in restaurants so much and in food media sort of generally. I think it's a really tricky one because there's a fine line between everything, but I think there's also not in many ways. Like, you know, there's a fine line between acting on a whisper of a whisper of a whisper about someone who you've never met to ignoring the fact that there's clearly malpractice going on within an establishment and still going to choose to eat there. And I think the first thing is that the food media needs to stop. It's not even necessarily calling out, but it needs to stop actively supporting these places. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, it needs to look in the same way that probably other kind of sections of the media have quite clear regulations as to how they can and can't report on things. I think in a similar sense, food media needs to take that responsibility and sort of have that clear regulation and clear sort of stance, because I think so often, you know, in another industry, like if you're reading a story about a footballer, if a footballer has been known to have done something wrong or is accused of doing something wrong, all the stories will say, you know, footballer's name, comma, whatever they are accused of or have been done wrong. Whereas in food, I don't feel like it's the same. And anyone who's done something previously, if they're still kind of circulating in the food sphere, it just says their name, Michelin star.
Legend. Yeah.
Like, and I'm just like, why are we still praising these people? And it is disappointing. And I obviously appreciate that, you know, food media is, and the whole of kind of like traditional print media is finding it so hard at the moment. And something that maybe is unique to the food media scene, but isn't necessarily, is that you're so reliant on the support of chefs for it being a successful publication, that there's almost this fear that if you stop supporting these one or two key chefs, they will suddenly, or, you know, other...
Yeah, if you're known to sort of sully reputations.
Yeah, then the whole industry will turn on you and like, I won't want to look at you. But I think it's a disappointing stance for the industry to take, because it just doesn't need to be like this. And I don't know any other industry that probably has as high a tolerance for something that's known to be such a wide problem. We all know it's there. It's not like sort of, you know, it's not like when the Me Too movement happened in the film industry, kind of maybe people in the industry knew it was there a little bit, but outside the industry, no one really thought there was maybe that many problems and everyone was really nice. And then suddenly it's all come out and everyone's being called out left, right and center. And that's really great. Whereas the whole world has a poor, you know, has a poor perception of the food industry and especially kitchens. And we just don't seem to have, I don't understand what the kind of light bulb moment will be where we're like, okay, well, if we want hospitality to be taken seriously as a career, we probably do need to clean up our reputation.
Yeah. The abusive chef is almost a trope. Like it's potentially even overdone. And like, I've worked with tons of chefs that were absolutely lovely and not abusive at all and like never raped anyone to my knowledge and like are just great, great people. And that far away is the people that I worked with that were shit. But the public perception is that like, well, chefs are, you know, emotional and violent and whatever.
I mean, the Bloody Bear. It's just so irritating.
I haven't seen it. Sometimes I just like at the end of my workday, it's like I can't actually think about how bad kitchens are for your mental health for one more minute. So. Yeah.
I think it's just like, it's that thing of like everyone's like, oh, you know, it's the double-edged sword of yes, it glamorizes kitchen brutality and things, but equally it's putting a spotlight on the industry and making chefs cool again. Well, I'm like, no, it's making being that type of chef cool again, which isn't cool. So it's not doing anything for the industry in my mind. It's just like, it's just perpetuating stereotypes and making people want to go into the industry for the wrong reason, which is again, disappointing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think especially when I think about the chefs I know who really consciously operate their kitchens in a way that's opposite to that sort of stereotype, and watching a TV show about them would be really boring. But yeah, working for them
is really great.
Is amazing. And in terms of career longevity and burnout and all of that stuff, like those are the guys you want to be employed by. And people, when they come to us and they ask like, oh, you know, I'm looking for a new job in London, not really sure. That's the biggest factor that we talk about. And in terms of like us directing people to certain restaurants is like, would this be a very entertaining 1-hour drama on HBO? Don't work there.
Yeah, literally. And it should be the same for all industries. Like if, you know, like if every magazine house, which I'm sure a lot of them were, if every magazine house was still like Devil Wears Prada, like it would be horrific. And so people wouldn't work there. And I think it was kind of like moving away from the chef thing a tiny bit. I think even like with front of house, there's that whole chaotic energy, like, you know, it's mental, but we love it type thing. And I think two people said something to me recently, whereas one, like Max from Forza, just said to me, I think one of the most important things we can do is like stop in pre-service briefing, be building it up as something and being like, okay, we're slammed tonight, but it's going to be, you know, we're going to rock it, like blah, blah, blah. And just be like, you know, we've got 180 covers tonight. We're busy. That's great. That's why we're all here. And like changing the framing of it, which I think is such a small thing, but actually probably if you're sat there and sort of for 5 minutes hammering home how stressful it's about to be, everyone's already stressed. And then it's too late. And I think the other one was I did a trial shift somewhere where I now do the night a week. And it was a slightly chaotic trial shift. I think someone hadn't turned up and it was really busy. And then sort of at the little chat at the end, they're like, I'm really sorry about that. You know, like that was really chaotic. It's not how it usually is. And I was like, oh, it's fine. Like, you know, I've worked like places like that before. And they're like, yeah, but this is why we leave these places. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I've never really maybe put two and two together. But yeah, if you want to have longevity in the industry, you just need stability and kindness and all the things which you shouldn't really have to ask for, but we still are.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think thinking about happiest places to work and sort of the role that something like that can play in elevating those workplaces, whereas so many of the lists, like, and obviously, like, we see all kinds of things and I talk to people all day about their experiences in the industry, and then I open a newspaper and it's like the best employer, the best places to work, and I'm like, and it's so obvious that it's pay to play that there isn't a lot of faith in that. And I think people in the industry, even if they've had really positive experiences with those employers, there isn't a lot of trust that what the media is sort of saying, like, here's the best places, really are. And I'm curious, when you guys do the report, how did you sort of build it to make sure that it was as reliable as possible and was really elevating places where people could go and have a positive experience, where that sort of burnout and that madness wasn't the bottom line?
Yeah, I think there's probably two things that we did as sort of, you know, sort of rules from the beginning. We didn't want it to be pay for entry, so it's free to enter, which allows smaller businesses who don't have budget for media spend to enter. And I think we also had a minimum uptake on people responding to the survey to say, you know, like, I work here and this is how I think of it, just so we can make sure that we're not getting the voice of a minority who are drowning out the majority who have been told not to respond to the survey. But I think that's kind of our stance on it. And I think, you know, it was the first year we did it as happiest places to work rather than happiness in hospitality. And there's lots of learnings for next year, whether we can include people who've worked there previously, not necessarily 10 years ago, because somewhere can obviously change in 10 years, but whether someone who's recently left could fill out the survey and we can understand why they're leaving.
Or being able to look at their exit survey data if they've got it.
Yeah, exactly. Like these types of things. And I think also just thinking about how we can drive up uptake, because the more people who respond to the survey and give honest opinions of how somewhere is to work, then the closer we can get to sort of giving an honest assessment of where we think the best places to work are in the industry. I think what was really nice for this list was that there were lots of single site places. It's again, you know, it's much easier to run a single site well, maybe, because maybe you don't have the resources of the bigger companies, but what you do have is control over that site. And if you are someone who wants to create a good workplace, that should be possible. I think what was a really interesting sort of transition, and maybe where we've championed places like Forza, who were the overall winner, was that we've seen that they've been able to recreate a culture they built in one site in two or three, which is so much easier said than done. And I think, you know, like, as soon as you can't be there every day, things start to get out of your control. And I think it was on the judging panel, Will Beckett said that the culture of my business is whenever I'm not there, you know, and it's true that is. That's the real assessment of sort of the happiness of the place to work. So yeah, it's been a really interesting process kind of learning on the job this year as to how to actually assess someone as an employer rather than assessing the industry as a whole.
What do you think surprised you the most out of the people that sort of applied or were contenders?
I think the innovation within the industry is really incredible. It didn't necessarily, not so much that I think the industry is not innovative. I think it's a massively innovative industry and, you know, it's been really responsive to so many challenges that have been thrown against it, but just things that you wouldn't necessarily, I think, you know, if you suggest a 4-day work week to someone who runs a restaurant, they're like, that's just not feasible. But like somewhere like Honest Crust in Manchester runs a 4-day work week successfully.
It's also, you can do it. You just have to pay people a full salary.
Yeah, it just you just have to be creative. You know, Forza give people free Birkenstock clogs, which is not a small expenditure to make, but it's a really nice touch. Invert in Scotland closed for 2 months a year, and they pay their staff a 50% salary if they come back after the fallow period. And like, that again is something we talk about, how tight margins are within hospitality, and in theory paying people whilst they're not working for you is something that should never be possible according to the kind of, you know,
talking
the
heads,
the kind of things we say, but it is. And I think that's probably been the most surprising thing. It's shown me what can be possible if you want to do it. And I think if anything, it's maybe like reduced my patience for people who say, oh, like, that's not possible. I'm like, well, it is. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. Someone's done it. Like, mm-hmm. You know, which is really, it's a positive and a negative, because I think it maybe, makes you think a little harsher towards those who aren't trying. You're like, I know you're not trying, or you don't want to. But maybe that's just the cynic in me. But yeah, it's been a really like positive thing to see all these amazing things restaurants are doing.
Yeah, I think it's hard when you become, because you can be so time poor, and it can take so much of you and take up so much of your life, that the idea of somebody coming in and being like, how about doing it a new way? You're like, fuck off and die. You know, like, you're tired. So I think that can be quite confrontational for people, but it's the simple changes. That's it can make a real difference. And I think something that we see as a sort of a common theme in all of the sort of reports and panels that we see that come out is if the team member feels valued, not as like a worker, but as a whole person. So not just like, you did amazing. You like, you know, you did 500 covers and that's brilliant. But like, we also acknowledge that like, you have feet that are now crumbling into dust.
Yeah.
Right. It's like looking at somebody more holistically than just a machine, I guess.
Yeah. And I think that was probably actually the hardest thing to sort of stomach that came out of the survey, was that overall I think we had about 3,000 people respond to it, and the thing the industry scored lowest in was making its staff feel valued, which is just like a really disappointing stat to see. And I think, you know, on an individual level, when you work somewhere great in hospitality, you can feel so valued because you're a key part of a team who's making something happen, and it should be so easy to make people feel valued and to empower them. Like, you know, if you're a restaurant who serves coffee, like, this is from that Will Goddara book, then give someone the responsibility over that coffee thing, and suddenly you've given them like a great sense of value because they're working on something they feel passionate about. But instead, that doesn't seem to be happening across the industry.
Well, I think it does sometimes, but what I see quite often in talking to people is that when that happens, it's often not compensated properly. So what will happen is that like, you're making the same amount, whether you are just somebody who works on the bar, or if you're somebody who's now going to do some ordering or curate the wine list, and you're getting paid the same amount of money. So that feels great initially, because you're like, oh, I'm valued and my skills being seen, and now I have some ownership. But then you're like, wait a second, am I being exploited? And it doesn't do what people think it does. And it doesn't have to be like an enormous amount. You don't have to pay them the same salary as a sommelier, but it's that acknowledgement. And why wouldn't you? Like, you're saving somebody else's time. If it was the ops manager who used to do it, or the supervisor who used to do it, now they've been able to claw back some minutes. And so why wouldn't you acknowledge that and pay them more? And those things have to go hand in hand.
Exactly. Yeah. Agreed completely. Yeah.
Can you tell me what frustrates you the most about your job?
What frustrates me the most? I'm a bit of a control freak. So I think sometimes I sort of, on all these campaigns, I do the project management side of things. And I think learning to let go, I think, is something that's important, and I'm learning to do. I think also there's a challenge for us around, we're a small company owned by a singular person, and we don't have the budgets of other similar style companies. And that's not necessarily a frustration, but sometimes it's really frustrating to look at someone doing something we've wanted to do for ages, and it's just like, they've done it because they've got VC backing of £10 million, and I'm just like, great, like, thanks for stealing our thunder on that one. But equally then, like, out of that frustration comes the need to be creative with the money we do have, and the need to really think about the content we're taking the time to produce, because, you know, if we're not creating something that's worthwhile, that's like a big chunk of our resource for the year gone, and we can't just afford to make, you know, spend 3 months doing something which doesn't work out. So I think it's frustrating in one way, but in another way it's made me work really hard to think about how we can best use the team we have and the resources we have to create the most relevant content for the industry. Do we always get it right? Definitely not. I think, you know, every year we do a wash up on like each campaign we've done or kind of like the year end total. And we're like, there's so much we could be doing better. But equally, I'm really proud of like what we do create with what we have. It's a frustration and a sort of a proud point.
What's the thing you love most about your job?
Probably the team, which I feel like I've been reading lots of nomination stuff recently, and like all the team stuff, I'm always like, oh, come on. But actually, you know, the team is so great. And we're all very different people with very different skills. And I think, like I say, sort of being a slightly impatient, control freaky person, it's really making me learn to sort of appreciate everyone's different skills. And also just we have fun, which I think, you know, can be really rare, especially in office environments. I think everyone can kind of put pressure on each other and look, sort of think that you're creating something bigger than it is. And, you know, the work that we do at Code is important within the industry, but we're not saving lives. And I think that's something that came up a lot recently around the Happiest Places to Work piece is, you know, lots of restaurants do have mantras where they're saying we're just cooking dinner at the end of the day. And I think that's something we all really embody. And I really like the fact that there's no one in there pushing us to sort of, we all go home at 5:30 and we log on at 9. And if something happens without outside those hours, at the end of the day, maybe, you know, we've said that a restaurant's in a different town to where it is. It's a bit annoying. We're sorry. But that's the end of the day. And I think that's the shared value set within the team is really great. And maybe something that I think the people who run Code, Adam and Will and Tiff, they've spent a really long time trying to build that. And they're really, really think about every hire, which I really, really sort of appreciate. I think, you know, sometimes you can be a bit like, oh, like they don't seem like a Code person, but then they're like, okay, no, you really thought about this. This is bang on. I just listened to Nigel Slater on the Modern House podcast, and he talks for 1.5 hours, and he just like, the way he speaks is so magical. And he was just talking about the way he builds his home. And he's like, I'll see. He's like, I don't think about buying furniture because I like it. I buy it because it fits in my house. And if I see it, I'll go back the next day. And, you know, I'll think about it for like 2 or 3 days. And I'm just like, I really want to have that mindset. And I don't have it right now. And I want to work towards it. But I'm really appreciative of the people who do have the ability to sit on a decision for 3 days, because it always ends up being a better one than the one made in haste.
Yeah, I think I have a bias for action. So I'd be similar to you where I'm just like, get it done.
Yeah.
And there is something really refreshing about when you have the capacity to take a more holistic approach and go slower. And I think it's something where the industry has suffered a bit in terms of recruitment in the past couple of years, where there hasn't been that capacity, because you're like, if I don't hire someone today, if there even is someone, like, you can't be as considered around building a team. But yeah, I think that's slowly starting to change. And I think it's only for the idea that we might be thoughtful about the kind of environments that we want to build and the way we want to employ people. But I think most importantly is that I noticed that individuals are feeling a lot more empowered to go into an environment, do a trial shift, and be like, you know what? I don't think this is the right place for me. Or I'm going to ask really smart questions about what their EAP is or what their benefits packages are, or what happens if I decide to have a kid. There's something about how much stronger individual workers are able to advocate for themselves that's really changed things a lot. And I think we have a tendency, like that process you're describing of like slowly building culture, slowly creating a certain vibe in a place. I think individuals feel a lot more empowered to do that for themselves in a way that's incredibly positive. And you can tell where the good places to work are by the vibe. But you know how, like, if you're in a restaurant and even if the food slaps, you can tell that everyone's miserable and you likely won't go back there. And you can go somewhere where the food's like pretty good and maybe one plate wasn't great and the dessert was banging and whatever, and it was a bit of a mixed bag. But if you can feel that people were having a good time, the service was lovely, you will continue to go back to that restaurant time and time again.
Yeah, and it's that thing that you never really, like 10 years down the line, I won't remember the food I was eating in that restaurant, unless it's that one dish, which I'll always remember. But I will always remember how the restaurant made me feel. And 90% of that is the people who are serving me. And so Yeah, and I think also it's that thing that probably the dual benefit of individuals sort of feeling more empowered to say those things is also that it will push those restaurants to start doing the right things. Because if you've been asked about an EAP 10 times and you don't have one, hopefully that is the indicator to you to get one. And hopefully, yeah, we'll see those benefits start to like trickle through into the overall industry.
Yeah, it's interesting because occasionally people will ask me like, well, don't you think that they're just like bringing mental health support because they're like trying to look good? And I'm like, maybe, but who gives a shit? Because that support's going to be there. And I think that for a lot of employers, they're like, oh, this is such a drag. Like now I have to like do my rota further in advance. Or there's all these ways that I used to operate that I can't do anymore because I'm not retaining people. And if I change the way that I operate, my retention will increase, but it's sort of begrudgingly. Great.
Like, yeah. I don't mind if people do the right things for the wrong reasons, as long as they're doing the right things. Yeah.
Because ultimately the folks that are going to be the most positively impacted, like they don't, like, of course it's nice if your motivation is also because it's the right thing to do, but I certainly don't think it's a requirement.
No.
And literally then there'd be like three places to work.
But they would get a lot of applicants.
If you could only go to one London restaurant for the rest of your life, what restaurant would it be?
See, that's a very hard question.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's like news night.
I think if I could go to Shiki's like 20 years ago, if it can be frozen in time, I'd maybe go there just on the nostalgia front. In the same way that like when I was 7, I think my grandparents, whenever they brought us into London, they'd always take us to the Harrods Food Hall. I don't want to eat there now, like in any way, shape or form. But if I can go from when it was frozen in time, when I was 6, I would love to go there. But I don't know. I think like I'm more of a pub man than maybe a restaurant man, which limits me in the places you can go back to. The menu's always different.
Yes.
So I'm a northeast man. And so I think I have to say the Plimsoll. I think the food there is really good. I think the vibe is good. Is the service always great? No. Do I care? Yes. Am I regretting my choice? Maybe. But you put me on the spot, and Shiki's and Harrods Dining Hall have both moved on. So I think for now I'll say the Plimsoll, but I think I probably will want to change it in a year.
Well, you can come back and you can select a new restaurant.
Please let me.
Okay, before you go, I just want to do some quick fire.
Okay, but I've immediately decided I want to change my restaurant.
Okay, let me ask you the question again. If you could only go to one London restaurant for the rest of your life, what restaurant would it be?
There is a restaurant near my family home, which we've been going to. Like I say, we come into London and stuff, but equally, we didn't always. There's a restaurant near my family home called The Plough in Baldhamhurst, which has been run by Jane and Michael for like 20 years. And it is just the best place ever. Like the hospitality, the same people have been in the front of house team like as long as I can remember. They know you by name. They're just so kind. The food is so good. And I think what really like embodies the level of hospitality they give is that when I was maybe 11, they used to serve, well, they still do actually, they serve these little like homemade biscuits with their teas and coffees. And my parents would order a tea or a coffee and I'd take the biscuits. And then I was like, I think these biscuits are the best things ever. I want to like, can I get the recipe? And like, and then I was like, maybe I'll sell them. Like maybe that's a genuine business. And Jane was just like, of course, take the recipe. You don't need to pay us anything. Like she just sort of gave me this recipe and was like, you know, supporting the idea that I'd be selling her biscuits for my profit. And obviously, you know, maybe there was an element of her who's like, there's an 11-year-old boy. It's very unlikely that this is going to take off into the UK's biggest biscuit business. But equally, I was just like, I look back on that so fondly that they gave me this biscuit recipe and just, you know, we're like, yeah, have it. Like, but we like you, you come here. And like, we always used to go at 6. My mum is the most unorganized person in the world. They're always fully booked. If my mum's like, can you save us a table at like, we'll be there at 5:30. And they'll be like, yeah, well, you know, we'll save you a little something. And then, you know, like we'd all be getting dressed in the car pretty much because there was no time. Mum would just be shoving us in, like, get in the car. So I think, you know, that is actually my favorite restaurant. And I'd never say no to going to that. I could eat that every day. They're just the best.
What's your, like, go-to dish there?
Ooh. I'd say it like it's so unoriginal, but they do a really, really good steak and chips, and it's it just like it's cooked. You know, it's taken its transition through the years. It used to be with crispy onions on top. It's not anymore. It used to be in a green egg. Now it's on a Josper grill. Like it's changing. It's always evolving. And so I feel like I could have it forever. Equally, I feel like most of the times I go there and I don't know why, there's always guinea fowl on the menu and it's always amazing. Or like pretty much anytime they put game on, I'm like, I'll have it. And it's always really good. But like, I don't know. I'm sounding like an enormous carnivore now. But
I like it. Meat only.
Yeah, it's a meat only menu for me. I think, you know, I actually couldn't tell you if I've ever eaten a vegetarian dish there in my life. Why would you?
The guinea fowl is so good.
It's very rural countryside, so I think guinea fowl is much more readily available than London.
Yeah, I feel like I was watching Celebrity Gogglebox at the weekend, and Nick Grimshaw's niece was saying how she really likes local food, but not too local. So, like, she wants to have a carrot from nearby London, but she doesn't want to eat one that was grown in London because she worries about the pollution. And I'm like, actually, fair fucks.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. And it's like, I do, if I'm in a pub in the countryside, I want to have like the locally sourced whatever. If I'm at my house, I think I'd prefer it came from a little farther afield.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Even the Fortnum & Mason's rooftop honey, I'm like, those bees are not healthy. Like, they're breathing in the smoke.
Sorry, there's bees on the roof at Fortnum & Mason?
I believe so, yeah. Yeah, they make their own honey. Obviously the bees, and then the Fortnum & Mason people take it, but...
Yeah, naturally. Yeah. Very interesting. It should definitely be tested for carcinogens, but also I'm very into that.
No, I love the idea, but I just think I don't really want... Well, apparently it's so good because there's such a diversity of flowers in London that it tastes amazing. It is like £17 a jar, so I've never had it.
I mean, and we're already breathing the air, so it's like the jig's up for us. We should have the honey. It's like the people that are from the countryside where I'm like, save yourselves. But yeah. We should be grand, right?
I hope, I pray. I mean, maybe, yeah, the tube, I think the tube's the end of all of us, but you know, that's a different...
I know, but I like the smells. Some of them smell exactly like the subway in New York for reasons I cannot understand. Really? And a few of them smell like the food hall from where I went to summer camp.
Fair enough. There's a nostalgia element to you, which can't be denied.
Yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment. What can I tell you? All right, I want to do some quick fire before I let you go. So first thing that comes to mind, what is your go-to meal when you need some comfort?
Pasta.
I thought you were going to say guinea fowl. kind of pasta?
Just like plain tomato pasta. It's what my dad used to make when we were younger, and he's a horrible cook, so it was the nicest thing he made by far.
Who is your celebrity crush?
I literally can't think of a celebrity.
You can't think of... Can you name a celebrity that you don't have a crush on?
I've gone so deeply blank. Like, there's not a single celebrity that's coming to mind.
Wow, incredible. Let me circle back. What is the best restaurant you've eaten at so far this year?
Oh, the Black Swan in Oldstead.
What is your favorite city in the UK?
Bristol.
Name one celebrity.
Bill Nye. Bill Nye actually would be my celebrity crush. He is the coolest man on the planet. Him walking around Soho, I'm just like, you look sick.
The best. And like, he's walking around Soho, you're walking around Soho. It's sick.
We're basically twins.
Basically. Okay, so I also want to ask who your hospitality hero is. So it can be someone that you're familiar with or not, but just somebody that you like know industry-ish and you're like, yes.
I think like close to home, my gran is probably my biggest hero. She's not here anymore. But she was the best like home cook ever. And I think she was the person who cooked in my auntie's deli, and she made all these takeaway frozen meals, which won all these great taste awards. And I think she just had like such a deep understanding of what people wanted to eat. Like, she in no way paid attention to trends. She in no way paid attention to anything other than exactly what she would have wanted to eat that night. And it was some of the weirdest stuff ever. Like, she did a frozen salmon pate, which people went nuts for. Like, I can't, and I was just like, I would never have thought that this would tap into some zeitgeist. And maybe that was where we lived. Like, everyone loved salmon pate. But yeah, and she just made pies and sticky toffee puddings and like frozen lasagnas. And so I think that on the level of both the quality of the cooking and the deep understanding of her customer, I think, and also the ability to seemingly chat all day and yet produce quiche upon quiche upon quiche. Like someone, you'd always go into her kitchen and there'd be like a stool for visitors where just someone would come and sit and chat to her. And she never seemed to be cooking. But yeah, at the end of the day, like 4,000 pies have been made. And yeah, I think like, what a woman. What a woman. But yeah, she definitely, I think, inspired a lot of my passion for the industry.
Do you remember something in particular that she would make that you loved?
Yeah, it was, this is again, fish and chips. But she made fish and chips. But like, again, this is like the home cook to the core. She also looked exactly like Mary Berry, by the way, like to the T. It's bonkers how alike they looked. Even had the same haircut. But she'd make fish and chips. She'd buy M&S. Like lightly battered haddock things, because she's like, I'm not battering my own fish. My granddad was her sous chef for the whole of their relationship, for like the 65 years they're married. And he'd make the chips, like cut them, and then she would cook them in a way I don't understand, but like they came out like deep fried chips from the oven. And then they do peas with, they're from Yorkshire, like the most butter you've ever seen, and also a healthy serving of sugar. And then this is the twist. Serve with parsley sauce. Yeah. And it was so good. And I just really remember like pretty much every Friday throughout my whole childhood, we'd go to their house and we'd eat it. And it was good. And even when I was like 22 before she died, like I'd go and she'd still make it. And I just felt like this is the best. And it's such a weird amalgamation of flavors. It's sweet. It's savory, it's other things. It's not what fish and chips should be, but it's how I wanted it to be. And we'll like never forget that meal for sure.
Has anyone in your family attempt to recreate it since she passed away?
No, the problem was she had, same as Mary Berry again, I think, had polio in her hands when she was a child. So couldn't really write down that well. And so the recipes were mainly in her head. So we have sort of this like broken scrapbook of recipes where, and also like, it was just so deeply unhelpful. Like her recipes for sausage roll is pastry, sausage meat, roll. I was just like, this isn't a recipe. And she was like, if you've got good ingredients, you don't need more than that. And I was just like, but seriously, how did you make it? Yeah, just didn't fuck around, knew what she was about. So yeah, I don't think I'll ever try and make it again because I just think I won't do it justice. But I do put sugar in my peas and I do enjoy oven-baked fish and chips for sure.
George, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Beyond the Pass is produced by Kelly's Cause. For more information about Kelly's Cause, please head to kellyscause.com or find us on Instagram @kellyscause.